or where or what. Mona is hungry. Her dress is thin. Nothing but evening wraps, bottles of perfume, barbaric earrings, bracelets, depilatories. We sit down in a billiard parlor on the Avenue du Maine and order hot coffee. The toilet is out of order. We shall have to sit some time before we can go to another hotel. Meanwhile, we pick bedbugs out of each other's hair. Nervous. Mona is losing her temper. Must have a bath. Must have this. Must have that. Must. How much money have you left? Money. Forgot all about that. Hotel des États-Unis. An ascenseur. We go to bed in broad daylight. When we get up, it is dark, and the first thing to do is to raise enough dough to send a cable to America. A cable to the fetus with the long, juicy cigar in his mouth. Meanwhile, there is the Spanish woman on the Boulevard Raspail. She's always good for a warm meal. By morning, something will happen. At least we're going to bed together. No more bedbugs now. The rainy season has commenced. The sheets are immaculate. A new life opening up for me at the Villa Borghese. Only 10 o'clock, and we have already had breakfast and been out for a walk. We have an Elsa here with us now. Step softly for a few days, cautions Boris. The day begins gloriously. A bright sky, a fresh wind, the houses newly washed. On our way to the post office, Boris and I discussed the book. The last book, which is going to be written anonymously. A new day is beginning. I felt it this morning as we stood before one of Dufresne's glistening canvases, a sort of déjeuner intime in the 13th century, sans vin. A fine, fleshy nude, solid, vibrant, pink as a fingernail, with glistening billows of flesh, all the secondary characteristics and a few of the primary. A body that sings, that has the moisture of dawn. A still life, only nothing is still, nothing dead here. The table creaks with food. It is so heavy it is sliding out of the frame. A 13th century repast, with all the jungle notes that he has memorized so well. A family of gazelles and zebras nipping the fronds of the palms. And now we have Elsa. She was playing for us this morning while we were in bed. Step softly for a few days. Good. Elsa is the maid, and I am the guest, and Boris is the big cheese. A new drama is beginning. I'm laughing to myself as I write this. He knows what is going to happen, that lynx, Boris. He has a nose for things, too. Step softly. Boris is on pins and needles. At any moment now, his wife may appear on the scene. She weighs well over 180 pounds, that wife of his, and Boris is only a handful. There you have the situation. He tries to explain it to me on our way home at night. It is so tragic and so ridiculous at the same time that I am obliged to stop now and then and laugh in his face. Why do you laugh so? He says gently, and then he commences himself with that whimpering, hysterical note in his voice, like a helpless wretch who realizes suddenly that no matter how many frock coats he puts on, he will never make a man. He wants to run away, to take a new name. She can have everything, that cow, if only she leaves me alone. He whines. But first the apartment has to be rented, and the deed signed, and 1,000 other details for which his frock coat will come in handy. But the size of her! That's what really worries him. If we were to find her suddenly standing on the doorstep when we arrive, he would faint. That's how much he respects her. And so we've got to go easy with Elsa for a while. Elsa is only there to make breakfast and to show the apartment. But Elsa is already undermining me. That German blood, those melancholy songs, coming down the stairs this morning with the fresh coffee in my nostrils, I was humming softly, Es wär so schön gewesen. For breakfast, that. And in a little while, the English boy upstairs with his Bach. As Elsa says, he needs a woman. And Elsa needs something, too. I can feel it. I didn't say anything to Boris about it, but while he was cleaning his teeth this morning, Elsa was giving me an earful about Berlin, about the women who look so attractive from behind, and when they turn round, wow, syphilis. It seems to me that Elsa looks at me rather wistfully. Something left over from the breakfast table. This afternoon we were writing, back to back, in the studio, She had begun a letter to her lover, who was in Italy. The machine got jammed. Boris had gone to look at a cheap room he will take as soon as the apartment is rented. There was nothing for it but to make love to Elsa. She wanted it. And yet I felt a little sorry for her. She had only written the first line to her lover. I read it out of the corner of my eye as I bent over her. But it couldn't be helped. That damned German music, so melancholy, so sentimental. It undermined me. And then her beady little eyes, so hot and sorrowful at the same time. After it was over, I asked her to play something for me. She's a musician, Elsa, even though it sounded like broken pots and skulls clanking. She was weeping, too, as she played. I don't blame her. Everywhere the same thing, she says. Everywhere a man, and then she has to leave, and then there's an abortion, and then a new job, and then another man, and nobody gives a fuck about her except to use her. All this after she's played Schumann for me. Schumann, that slobbery, sentimental German bastard. Somehow I feel sorry as hell for her, and yet I don't give a damn. A cunt who can play as she does ought to have better sense than be tripped up by every guy with a big putz who happens to come along. But that Schumann gets into my blood. She's still sniffling, Elsa, but my mind is far away. I'm thinking of Tanya and how she claws away at her adagio. I'm thinking of lots of things that are gone and buried. Thinking of a summer afternoon in Greenpoint when the Germans were romping over Belgium and we had not yet lost enough money to be concerned over the rape of a neutral country. A time when we were still innocent enough to listen to poets and to sit around a table in the twilight rapping for departed spirits. All that afternoon and evening the atmosphere is saturated with German music. The whole neighborhood is German, more German even than Germany. We were brought up on Schumann and Hugo Wolf and sauerkraut and kimmel and potato dumplings. Toward evening we're sitting around a big table with the curtains drawn and some fool two-headed wench is rapping for Jesus Christ. We're holding hands under the table, and the dame next to me has two fingers in my fly. And finally we lie on the floor behind the piano while someone sings a dreary song. The air is stifling, and her breath is boozy. The pedal is moving up and down, stiffly, automatically, a crazy, futile movement, like a tower of dung that takes 27 years to build but keeps perfect time. I pull her over me with the sounding board in my ears. The room is dark, and the carpet is sticky with the kimmel that has been spilled about. Suddenly it seems as if the dawn were coming. It is like water purling over ice, and the ice is blue with a rising mist, glaciers sunk in emerald green, chamois and antelope, golden groupers, sea cows mooching along, and the amberjack leaping over the Arctic rim. Elsa is sitting in my lap. Her eyes are like little belly buttons. I look at her large mouth, so wet and glistening, and I cover it. She is humming now. Es wäre so schön gewesen. Ah, Elsa, you don't know yet what that means to me. Your Trompeter von Seckingen, German singing societies, Schwaben Hall, the Turnverein, linksum, rechtsum, and then a whack over the ass with the end of a rope. Ah, the Germans. They take you all over like an omnibus. They give you indigestion. In the same night, one cannot visit the morgue, the infirmary, the zoo, the signs of the zodiac, the limbos of philosophy, the caves of epistemology, the arcana of Freud and Steckel. On the merry-go-round, one doesn't get anywhere, whereas with the Germans, one can go from Vega to Lope de Vega, all in one night, and come away as foolish as Parsifal. As I say, the day began gloriously. It was only this morning that I became conscious again of this physical Paris of which I had been unaware for weeks. Perhaps it is because the book has begun to grow inside me. I am carrying it around with me everywhere. I walk through the streets big with child, and the cops escort me across the street. Women get up to offer me their seats. Nobody pushes me rudely anymore. I am pregnant. I waddle awkwardly, my big stomach pressed against the weight of the world. It was this morning on our way to the post office that we gave the book its final imprimatur. We have evolved a new cosmogony of literature, Boris and I. It is to be a new Bible, the last book. All those who have anything to say will say it here, anonymously. We will exhaust the age. After us, not another book, not for a generation at least. Heretofore we had been digging in the dark, with nothing but instinct to guide us. Now we shall have a vessel in which to pour the vital fluid, a bomb which, when we throw it, will set off the world. We shall put into it enough to give the writers of tomorrow their plots, their dramas, their poems, their myths, their sciences. The world will be able to feed on it for 1,000 years to come. It is colossal in its pretentiousness. The thought of it almost shatters us. For 100 years or more, the world, our world, has been dying, and not one man in these last 100 years or so has been crazy enough to put a bomb up the asshole of creation and set it off. The world is rotting away, dying piecemeal, but it needs the coup de grace, it needs to be blown to smithereens. Not one of us is intact, and yet we have in us all the continents and the seas between the continents and the birds of the air. We are going to put it down, the evolution of this world which has died but which has not been buried. We are swimming on the face of time, and all else has drowned, is drowning, or will drown. It will be enormous, the book. There will be oceans of space in which to move about, to perambulate, to sing, to dance, to climb, to bathe, to leap somersaults, to whine, to rape, to murder. A cathedral, a veritable cathedral, in the building of which everybody will assist who has lost his identity. There will be masses for the dead, prayers, confessions, hymns, a moaning and a chattering, a sort of murderous insouciance. There will be rose windows and gargoyles and acolytes and pallbearers. You can bring your horses in and gallop through the aisles. You can butt your head against the walls, they won't give. You can pray in any language you choose, or you can curl up outside and go to sleep. It will last 1,000 years at least, this cathedral, and there will be no replica, for the builders will be dead, and the formula too. We will have postcards made and organize tours. We will build a town around it and set up a free commune. We have no need for genius. Genius is dead. We have need for strong hands, for spirits who are willing to give up the ghost and put on flesh. The day is moving along at a fine tempo. I am up on the balcony at Tanya's place. The drama is going on down below in the drawing room. The dramatist is sick, and from above his scalp looks more scabrous than ever. His hair is made of straw. His ideas are straw. His wife, too, is straw, though still a little damp. The whole house is made of straw. Here I am, up on the balcony, waiting for Boris to arrive. My last problem, breakfast, is gone. I have simplified everything. If there are any new problems, I can carry them in my rucksack along with my dirty wash. I am throwing away all my sous. What need have I for money? I am a writing machine. The last screw has been added. The thing flows. Between me and the machine there is no estrangement. I am the machine. They have not told me yet what the new drama is about, but I can sense it. They are trying to get rid of me. Yet here I am for my dinner, even a little earlier than they expected. I have informed them where to sit, what to do. I ask them politely if I shall be disturbing them, but what I really mean, and they know it well, is, will you be disturbing me? No, you blissful cockroaches, you are not disturbing me. You are nourishing me. I see you sitting there close together, and I know there is a chasm between you. Your nearness is the nearness of planets. I am the void between you. If I withdraw, there will be no void for you to swim in. Tanya is in a hostile mood. I can feel it. She resents my being filled with anything but herself. She knows by the very caliber of my excitement that her value is reduced to zero. She knows that I did not come this evening to fertilize her. She knows there is something germinating inside me which will destroy her. She is slow to realize, but she is realizing it. Sylvester looks more content. He will embrace her this evening at the dinner table. Even now he is reading my manuscript, preparing to inflame my ego, to set my ego against hers. It will be a strange gathering this evening. The stage is being set. I hear the tinkle of the glasses. The wine is being brought out. There will be bumpers downed, and Sylvester, who is ill, will come out of his illness. It was only last night at Kronstadt's that we projected this setting. It was ordained that the women must suffer, that offstage there should be more terror and violence, more disasters, more suffering, more woe and misery. It is no accident that propels people like us to Paris. Paris is simply an artificial stage, a revolving stage that permits the spectator to glimpse all phases of the conflict. Of itself, Paris initiates no dramas. They are begun elsewhere. Paris is simply an obstetrical instrument that tears the living embryo from the womb and puts it in the incubator. Paris is the cradle of artificial births. Rocking here in the cradle, each one slips back into his soil. One dreams back to Berlin, New York, Chicago, Vienna, Minsk. Vienna is never more Vienna than in Paris. Everything is raised to apotheosis. The cradle gives up its babes and new ones take their places. You can read here on the walls where Zola lived, and Balzac, and Dante, and Strindberg, and everybody who ever was anything. Everyone has lived here some time or other. Nobody dies here. They are talking downstairs. Their language is symbolic. The word struggle enters into it. Sylvester, the sick dramatist, is saying, "I am just reading the manifesto," and Tanya says, "Whose?" "Yes, Tanya, I heard you. I am up here writing about you, and you divine it well. Speak more, that I may record you. For when we go to table, I shall not be able to make any notes." Suddenly Tanya remarks, "There is no prominent hall in this place." Now what does that mean, if anything? They are putting up pictures now. That, too, is to impress me. See, they wish to say, "We are at home here, living the conjugal life, making the home attractive. We will even argue a little about the pictures, for your benefit." And Tanya remarks again, "How the eye deceives one." "Ah, Tanya, what things you say. Go on, carry out this farce a little longer. I am here to get the dinner you promised me. I enjoy this comedy tremendously." And now Sylvester takes the lead. He is trying to explain one of Borowski's gouaches. "Come here, do you see? One of them is playing the guitar. The other is holding a girl in his lap." "True, Sylvester. Very true. Borowski and his guitars. The girls in his lap. Only one never quite knows what it is he holds in his lap, or whether it is really a man playing the guitar." Soon, Moldorf will be trotting in on all fours, and Boris with that helpless little laugh of his. There will be a golden pheasant for dinner, and Anjou, and short, fat cigars. And Kronstadt, when he gets the latest news, will live a little harder, a little brighter, for 5 minutes, and then he will subside again into the humus of his ideology, and perhaps a poem will be born, a big, golden bell of a poem without a tongue. Had to knock off for an hour or so. Another customer to look at the apartment. Upstairs, the bloody Englishman is practicing his Bach. It is imperative now, when someone comes to look at the apartment, to run upstairs and ask the pianist to lay off for a while. Elsa is telephoning the greengrocer. The plumber is putting a new seat on the toilet bowl. Whenever the doorbell rings, Boris loses his equilibrium. In the excitement, he has dropped his glasses. He is on his hands and knees. His frock coat is dragging the floor. It is a little like the Grand Guignol, the starving poet come to give the butcher's daughter lessons. Every time the phone rings, the poet's mouth waters. Mallarmé sounds like a sirloin steak, Victor Hugo like foie de veau. Elsa is ordering a delicate little lunch for Boris, a nice juicy little pork chop, she says. I see a whole flock of pink hams lying cold on the marble, wonderful hams cushioned in white fat. I have a terrific hunger, though we've only had breakfast a few minutes ago. It's the lunch that I'll have to skip. It's only Wednesdays that I eat lunch, thanks to Borowski. Elsa is still telephoning. She forgot to order a piece of bacon. "Yes, a nice little piece of bacon. Not too fatty," she says. "Zut alors. Throw in some sweetbreads, throw in some mountain oysters and some psst clams. Throw in some fried liverwurst while you're at it. I could gobble up the 1,500 plays of Lope de Vega in one sitting." It is a beautiful woman who has come to look at the apartment. An American, of course. I stand at the window with my back to her, watching a sparrow pecking at a fresh turd. Amazing how easily the sparrow is provided for. It is raining a bit, and the drops are very big. I used to think a bird couldn't fly if its wings got wet. Amazing how these rich dames come to Paris and find all the swell studios, a little talent, and a big purse. If it rains, they have a chance to display their brand new slickers. Food is nothing. Sometimes they're so busy gadding about that they haven't time for lunch. Just a little sandwich, a wafer at the Café de la Paix or the Ritz bar. For the daughters of gentlefolk only, that's what it says at the old studio of Puvis de Chavannes. Happened to pass there the other day, rich American cunts with paint